All right. Well, here we are. It's Wednesday night again.
Hello.
I like these sessions because I'm always like, oh, it's midweek. We're like halfway through. I can see Friday just over the horizon.
It's so close.
It's so close. Yeah. So, how did you survive the snowpocalypse of 2026?
Well, after we moved, it's not even a concern really anymore. I don't have to do any shoveling, so I just stayed indoors and hunkered down, but I doubt
Oh,
that was your experience.
no, I shoveled 5 times. We got a
That's a lot
lot of
of shoveling.
snow. I measured it off the back deck, and I had shoveled a path out to the barbecue and everything like before the storm. So I was, I know it's not perfect, but our backyard's pretty closed in, and I was measuring it. I think in pretty much a place that I already cleared off. And if I'm remembering, in our backyard, there were 47, 48 centimeters. Like
Oh my
it
God.
snowed for like 24 hours straight. It didn't stop. And then I saw something from, I guess it was Environment Canada, and I don't know where they measured this, but they said in Oakville it was like 50 centimeters or something. So we were, my back deck was a
Pretty
pretty
much.
good measure of it. Yeah. So.
I can't remember the last time we got that much snow, to be quite honest. Like that was a historic snowfall, it felt like. It's crazy.
It's crazy. I was talking to my neighbor, and they moved here, I don't know, like pandemic sort of time frame, right? And we were out shoveling snow, and he's like, "Have you ever seen snow like this? Like here?" And I'm like, "Well, not in recent memory, but I'm pretty sure like we've had this much snow over an entire season since we've lived here." But to get it all in like a 24-hour span, I can't recall ever having that. So yeah, that was fun. Yeah, it was
I
fun.
bet. Do you have a snow blower or were you doing it the old-fashioned way?
Well, okay, so and that's one of the reasons why I shoveled like 5 times, because I have one of those like a little electric snow shovels. Have you seen those things? It's
I
like
have seen
battery
those.
powered. It's some, Chinese brand. I got it off Amazon. It was super cheap. It was like $100 or something. And I'm like, okay, for $100, I'm willing to risk it if it keeps me from shoveling. And that thing has been a beast. But I didn't let the snow get like super deep, but it was so light. Like it was blowing it all over the place. Now, when the snow plow came by, that was a different story. And luckily I had the old snow blower. I have like a plug-in electric one, and it handled the end of the driveway no problem. I don't think the little electric shovel would have, so
Yeah,
I
probably
did
not.
save myself a little bit of pain and suffering, having a couple electric devices to alleviate some of the lifting. Although the damn snow was so light, right? It was probably wouldn't have been overly bad to shovel it, but I'm glad I didn't have to. It was
Yeah,
okay.
for sure. That I mean, that's the worst part of winter up here is the shoveling, so.
The only good thing is with it being so cold, like it wasn't too bad. At least it wasn't like 50 centimeters of almost
Wet
rain. Yeah.
slush,
Yeah. Slush just falling in the driveway. So that was good. And then what was the other thing you made me think of that was snow related? It popped into my head and then it was gone. If it comes up, I'll just interrupt later and I'll. As I remind myself suddenly. All right, so let's get started. I've got a couple interesting things on the AWS news front. I'm just going to read again, like top to bottom. The first article I came across that I thought was really interesting was an announcement of Bedrock Agent Core browser feature now supports custom browser extensions. So my first thought was on this was like, it just kind of, I don't really know why it jumped out at me. I had no clue what this feature was, to be frank. I had to go and look, right? So I'm like, well, what the hell is Agent Core Browser. It's sort of, you can make a logical connection, but I'm like, what is this? So I went and I looked, and essentially it's a cloud-based browser solution that you can access programmatically to allow your AI agents to go off and basically interact with websites. Makes sense, okay. Right? Yeah. Kind of right in the name. And then this new feature allows you to create your own custom browser extensions, store them in S3, and then have that cloud-based browser use those depending on, again, what you've tasked it with, right? Whether it's some sort of automation, whether it's like web scraping or something like that. So never heard of it, but I think it kind of resonates with a couple of things we've talked about over the last little while, just around automation and, you know, this idea of having agents do this type of work for you. I don't know if you had a look at that one, or what do you think?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that makes perfect sense. One of the most powerful ways to interact with your browser is through extensions, right? So I'm sure you could have all kind. I mean, whatever you want, really. Write your own scraping, maybe like session storage, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The sky's the limit, really. If you can, if it's just any browser plugin that you like, if you can write your own and upload them, then yeah, you can do whatever you want with that. If you have to go through like the Chromium or Chrome store or extension provider, that's a little different, but that's interesting.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I kind of poked around a little bit to try to figure it out. And all I could really find was in the news release, they basically said something like, hey, you upload your extensions to S3 and then your browser just can use them.
You have to follow the Chromium guidelines. So it has to be the same format.
Yeah, but then you just dump them in your S3 bucket and away they go. But then also to think about it on the potential pitfalls, and it'll tie into something we talk about later, but again, like, what the heck is in that bucket? And, you know, if somebody puts something in there and your browser just decides it wants to use it because the text.
Yeah, thing, well.
You know what I mean? Like, oof, you'd want to be careful.
Any agentic system you have that's like automatically scraping a website for info, maybe you're loading up these extensions, you could even, there are credential extensions for AWS that you can use, right? Which is, you shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
It's a little risky, but you could.
You could, yeah.
And that's just, it's another vector for exfiltration, right? It's just another problem.
Yeah, which we've talked about like over the last couple of weeks. Like my first thought was, this is cool, but you'd sure want to make sure that you've got, I'm going to use the phrase guardrails, right? Around the infrastructure that this browser is going to use. Like, what's in the S3 bucket? You know, is it valid? All of that kind of stuff before suddenly the agent starts to try to use it, right?
Yeah, 100%. Like, this is a huge risk.
Yeah. What I'm noticing, actually, I'll save that for later, because I think it fits better into the Gen AI stuff. I think this would be something that would be pretty cool to, to kind of try out. Like I was thinking as I was reading, I'm like, what kind of use case? And in the documentation I was reading, they do the same old thing, right? Like, go buy me shoes or book me a trip. And I'm like, okay, these are all the standard demos you get, but I couldn't think off the top of my head of like how I would use this in my day-to-day work, but it still seems pretty interesting. And I guess it's just another tool, really.
It's just another tool that your agent can call. And on one use case I found, and there's plenty of these web fetch extensions that you can use for various agentic tools, right? But if you need to do some research on a subject or a topic, you could maybe even configure an extension to have like a preset list of URLs or domains that you want to go to, or lock it up that way.
Yeah.
I imagine.
Yeah.
So you do something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I use these for doing deep research on topics. I'll just send them out a bunch of parallel agents and go and scrape whatever. Yeah.
I've been thinking about, like, I use the, what is it called? MCP Docker toolkit a lot. So I kind of have all of my MCPs and stuff all configured there. And then I just configure my client to use, basically to talk to Docker And then it's got access to all of the, I don't have to individually, because I jump between different things, right? So that way I don't have to configure each one with my MCPs and stuff. And I've often considered putting, like, I know there's a fair number of them out there, like the sort of this idea of a browser extension. I've often thought of adding one just to see what it could do. But honestly, the only time I ever do anything is when I tell Kiro to make sure it's using the official AWS documentation, and it goes off and does what I need it to do anyway. So I'm not doing any fancy sort of web browsing or anything that I can think of where I would need something more than what I already have just sort of built into something like Kiro.
Yeah, fair enough. Maybe there's some use case for like getting screenshots or pages, or there's some scraping specific workflows that you might want for parsing like rendered websites, spas, that kind of thing. But
All right. So the next one that I had, it caught my attention because we've talked about the Frontier agents that AWS announced at reInvent, back in November, December. And this was an update or a new feature for the security agent, which I think we mentioned sort of in passing when they announced it, but it now supports GitHub Enterprise Cloud. So you would need a certain type of license, as far as I can tell, in GitHub. But you're able now to configure that agent to connect to your private repos. They gave examples of like, you know, doing code scans and things like that as part of your security reviews. I haven't tried this. It's again been on my radar as something to try. And I think I really should get serious about doing it because it's still free in preview. Not saying that I would connect it to GitHub or anything like that, but it's free in preview. Why not at least kind of test the capabilities? So introducing new features might be a good time now to try them out while they're still free, right?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Reminds me a bit of Devin, right? Like a lot of the use case for that is to go and make automatic PRs and clean up issues on your repo.
Yeah.
This is more obviously geared to, we're going to do some static analysis, we're going to do some security scanning on your code. But it's, you know, another layer of security that you could add, and it could be interesting to check out at least while it's free, right?
Yeah.
I'll probably spin it up and see what it does.
Yeah. You mentioned Devin there. I'm like, wow, I haven't heard that one in a while.
Yeah. They're kind of fell off the radar, right? A little bit.
Yeah. They like exploded. Everybody was like, oh my God, have you tried this? And then it was just gone.
Yeah.
I guess that's what it's going to be like, right? Interesting things are going to come to life and they're going to expire very quickly. I'm sure it's still around, but it's just not as sort of newsworthy as it was when they first released it.
Yeah, I think they had the huge hype and then they did that press tour, like we're going to replace every software engineer type thing.
Yeah.
And now I guess they're just paying off their promise debt, as it were.
You made me Google it. Yeah, it's still, they're still pitching it as the software engineer, the AI software engineer.
It's kind of interesting that now it seems like the frontier models like Opus are doing everything that Devin can do, but they're just the model, right?
Yeah.
So we'll see how this evolves. It's really, it's going very quickly.
And all these things, you know what? All these things almost feel indistinguishable at this point. Like I'm scrolling through the website and it has all the same stuff, right? Like, you know, agents working together, hundreds of tools, MCPs, connect them together. It's almost kind of like, oh, there's the GitHub connection, all of that stuff. It's kind of like find a tool that you like to use and just use it if the price is right.
Totally.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it might be a race to the bottom. They're so similar.
I think you're probably right. Okay. So, and the other thing I wrote down about the security agent, just like the DevOps agent, right now it's only available in US East 1.
Right.
I was going to do a little demo on the DevOps agent. And I stood up some infrastructure. I had it in a CDK project, and you know, I'm like, okay, well, I'll deploy this infrastructure, and then in my demo, I won't you know, codify the agent. We'll just deploy it through the management console to see how it works. So I'm right. kind of walking through it to make sure I know at least what the hell I'm going to do, right? And I'm like, oh, damn, I deployed everything into CA Central 1 just out of habit. So I have to rip it all down and deploy it again into US East 1. I'm sure it could do
Classic.
Cross account or cross region, but I'm like,
yeah,
I don't want to figure that out. I'll just keep it all in one place and make it a little easier on myself.
That's fair.
Yeah. 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 So what else do I have? Oh, this one isn't our normal AWS news. It's more Amazon news, but it grabbed my attention. It showed up in an RSS feed or something. The Dash Cart. So
yes,
this is like a really cool shopping cart that has limited usage, I guess. It's in Whole Foods, only in the States, and they're releasing like a new version of it. And I was reading the little news article, and I think it's only available in like Texas or something like that, like Whole Foods in Texas. But okay, so let me go through the features of this thing. Okay. It's a shopping cart. So you're thinking, what the hell do you need on a shopping cart? But in true Amazon fashion, right? They've just basically taken a bunch of technology and added it to a shopping cart to streamline the shopping experience. So it has a built-in screen, right? So as you're shopping, it'll show you savings opportunities in the store. It will show you a running tally of what's in your cart. It will also it also has a built-in map. So if you're trying to find something specific,
oh, that's handy.
It'll tell you where it is in the store, right? You don't have to go bother the kid, and the kid's like, oh, what the hell are you talking about, right? I just started today. I don't know what you're talking about. So it's got all this
technology. The aisle
sign. Yeah, yeah. Just look at the aisle signs. It even has a built-in scale. So if you're buying produce or whatever, you just put it on the scale and away you go. It has what was the other thing it had? I'm missing something important. Oh, choose how you want to pay. So you can basically, as you're putting things into the cart, it's scanning them. It understands how much your bill is. And then I think they had a fancy couple trademark names for it or whatever. But basically, you could just decide you want to pay with your Amazon account, you know, credit card or whatever, and just not even have to stop at the front. Just out you go.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a tap to pay NFC chip in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Guaranteed.
And then the last thing, it's a lighter shopping cart with more capacity. And that made me chuckle. I'm like, well, of course it is. You know, I want you to put more groceries in this cart in order to get the bill up. But I just thought it was cool. Like, I'm a sucker for technology. And it just made me smile as I was reading through all the technology in a shopping cart.
That's pretty neat. I would not have expected someone to staple an iPad to a shopping cart, but here we are.
Leave it to Amazon to do it, though, right?
Yeah.
And then my next thing, and I know this is easy to say because I know there's a lot of technology in these stores, right, to basically facilitate the use of this type of thing. But I'm thinking to myself, like, you wonder why sometimes Amazon will eat other people's lunch. Like, I know this is a silly little thing, but to have the ability to kind of, you know, see your bill as you're going through, maybe that you know, helps you make different decisions as you're shopping. Like, why the heck isn't this in every shopping, grocery store, department store, if they still exist? You know, you would think that everybody would have something, maybe not quite as fancy, but something similar on a cart.
Yeah, or some kind of app that you could scan the barcodes with as you go, kind of thing, would make sense. Yeah. I think, it's interesting, right? I mean, there's obviously, it's expensive to stick a tablet on a shopping cart, and each cart has a terminal on it, right? So you have to, and the scale, so there's some tech there.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're replicating the online shopping experience on a physical cart is what's happened here, right?
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. I just think it's cool.
So. Yeah,
I'm not going to Texas to try out the Dash Cart, but if it ever shows up in a local Whole Foods, not that I shop at Whole Foods, but I might
wander
over just to push the fancy cart around for a while. Put a couple expensive items in my cart. Asparagus water.
Now,
wasn't that the big thing a couple of years ago? They were charging like, you know, a bunch of money for a cup of water a thing of asparagus in it. And people were like, their minds. No, I'm sure it was. Hold on. Now you got to, I got to look.
It's got to be cucumber. Please tell me it's cucumber and not asparagus.
I think it was asparagus water.
Oh, that's vile.
This is on CBC. Whole Foods admits trying to sell asparagus water for $6 was a mistake.
$6?
Shoppers laughs $6 bottle of water with asparagus stock straight off the shelves. So there you go. It was a real thing. A 473 milliliter bottle of asparagus water.
Wow.
Yeah. Asparagus water?
That is probably the worst vegetable that I can think of to do that with, maybe.
Yeah, I think so, right?
Yeah, that's not even, like a fruit adjacent thing.
I can imagine somebody sitting around going, oh, damn, nobody's buying this asparagus. What are you going to do with it? We'll put it in water. And
I've got an idea.
Yeah, let's see what happens. So there's our fun AWS news article for the week. The fancy new dash cart with more technology on it than you can imagine.
I don't want to be the guy changing the receipt rules on these things.
They probably don't even print a receipt. It probably just goes to your like Amazon account.
Let's just get emailed. Something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So that's the AWS news that sort of jumped out at me over the last week. Let's see. Let's change gears. We got a lot of Gen AI stuff to get
through.
There's
a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first one, again, no particular order. Just because we talked about Ollama last week, I decided that I would put the Ollama blog in my RSS feed, and they're announcing a lot of stuff. So this is new feature for Ollama called Launch. And essentially what it allows you to do is launch your favorite coding tools like Codex and Claude by running an Ollama command and then deciding whether you want to use either local or cloud-based models when you run that launch command. So yeah, you know, I poke around with Ollama every once in a while, and I usually get distracted too quickly to really spend some time with it, but it just, you know, piqued my interest because we've been talking about sort of local models and smaller models that you can run well locally versus cloud-based stuff. So just grabbed my attention. Any thoughts on that one?
It seems like a good way to route if you want to use one of the, or you want to try out a local model, right? If you have the hardware to run it. Yeah. And then also keep your cloud-based access handy just in case you want to continue using your API keys or your subscription. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, it's kind of one of those things. There's not really much to say about it, but it's just, it seems like recently Ollama's been releasing a lot of new features.
The tooling is getting good for local models, which is nice.
Yeah.
And there have been some new releases just even over the past 2 weeks that look pretty compelling. So,
yeah, which I think we'll talk about one that you shared a little later.
Yeah.
The next two articles, they're both related to something we talked about, I think last week, ClaudeBot. And
oh, yes.
This a couple interesting things here. So, first, ClaudeBot is no longer ClaudeBot. It's MoltBot. Right. Ooh, I'm getting a warning about disk space right in the middle of the stream.
Uh-oh.
Hang on. That can't be good.
Clear some room.
Quickly. You know,
video files always take up more than you expect.
This the other day, I'm like, you should probably move some of that stuff off to another storage platform. And then, you know, I didn't. Hold on. Let me just see how much space we actually have. Can we make it through the next 30 minutes? More info. Storage. Oh, this is hilarious. Not one thing. We're not going to make it to the end. I've used 492 gigs of 495 gigs. Okay, so just
give me one second.
Can we just empty the trash? Oh, the trash might get us to the end of the stream.
We're going to get there? Okay.
We're going to get there. We have this empty trash. Mm-hmm. I'm a forder. I just keep all of my trash around just in case I want to get it back for something.
You never know.
You
might want that file.
Okay, let me just quickly save another. Oh, I feel bad about what I'm about to do. It's asking for a password. I might actually delete PyCharm.
When was the last time you opened PyCharm?
Here we go. It actually has last access. Look. It says, this has to be wrong. It's now the largest application on my hard drive. It said I opened it in December. Oh, that's true, because I did a class and I wanted to show them how Kiro worked in an IDE. And I'm like, well, the easiest way to do it and something that would look probably similar to what you're doing would be PyCharm. So I actually used PyCharm.
Yep.
There you go. I wish it said, what was the time before the last time that you used it? Because I bet you it was a long time. Okay, I think we're probably going to survive. I know what I'm doing after the streams.
A little tidying.
I think you're right. I think it's all cleaning. The podcast files, all the video files that I just...
It's got to be.
Got to be, yeah. So let's go back to the regular show. So ClaudeBot, first off, is no longer ClaudeBot. It's now referred...
Yes.
It's now called MoltBot. Okay. Yeah.
Anthropic is getting... yet another in the Anthropic saga of going after these indie devs.
Yeah. So trademark concerns. If you're not familiar, if somebody's listening and you're not familiar, ClaudeBot is essentially an AI assistant, right? That allows you to do all sorts of stuff your favorite messaging app. Like it'll support, I think it supports Slack, but WhatsApp, Telegram. There was a bunch of them, right?
Discord, all kinds.
Yeah. And imagine what happened where suddenly... how do I want to explain it? Basically people are standing this up because it was all the rage there for the last couple weeks. And inadvertently, a bunch of people have stood them up in a way that makes it publicly accessible. And it didn't take somebody very long to run some tools and essentially find hundreds of these AI assistants just sitting on the public internet. Some of them were secured, but a lot of them were not. So
I do have an update about...
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
About that.
Yeah.
So the original Shodan scan, which if you're not familiar, Shodan is essentially a scanning service that scans the internet for open ports.
Yeah.
Devices that are exposed, that kind of thing. The original query wasn't the best for the reporting on this, but after someone fine tuned it, it came out like 12 or 14 that were misconfigured, publicly open. Exposed.
Okay.
Yeah. But you could run a reverse proxy out of that network. You probably shouldn't. That will expose it, right?
Yeah.
But it's not as bad as it sounds, but still you're still leaving yourself open to all kinds of attacks. So
yeah. The thing that sort of got me with this was just how easy it is if you're not careful to have some unintended consequences. Like,
yeah,
it made for great reading, and you know, I think it's still like a really good cautionary tale for all of these tools that I would expect to see a absolute shit ton of in 2026, right? So
yeah,
make sure you know what it is that you're actually doing before just firing up the next thing and seeing what it does, right? I think you have to be careful.
Totally. It's essentially like the vectoring this again was a malicious skill that they implanted, and essentially jailbroke Cloudbot to go and download and set it up, right? It has a lot of automation features like that, which is really too bad because it's a really useful tool, especially I found out if you're disabled. It's a great tool for accessing your computer and running, doing pretty much anything you want on there, right? Because it supports voice memo connectivity.
Or
you can connect it up to whatever messaging app, right? Like if you have a way to input text, you can interact with this thing. Yeah. So I hope we get the security figured out. It's kind of unfortunate that we're moving in a direction where we're just going all in on the fuzzy matching logic system, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, it's going to be a rough time for security people for the next 10, 20 years.
Right. Yeah. You know, I wrote down here what's old is new again. And it reminds me, like, these things are cyclical, right? Like, remember the old days, you probably don't, but I do, of BBSs where you were dialing a modem. And I'm not saying I did this, but you could have spent a whole lot of time looking for modems that would have just answered, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then you fast forward in time a little bit, and then you used to be able to just wander around your neighborhood and find all sorts of open Wi-Fi networks. And people figured out how to close those down. I think we're kind of doing the same thing again, right?
Like, again,
it's exciting, it's fun. People want to see how this stuff works and experiment. And they're just maybe not completely understanding some of the things that these tools might do if they're misconfigured, right? So now we're in the phase of just open AI agents, and it's an education process. Like, hey, these are all fantastic things. Just make sure that you've configured them properly.
We're in the phone freaking phase, right?
There you go. Yeah. I didn't think of that one. That's a good analogy.
Like, every modem is exposed. You can get into anything you want, basically. You have to social engineer a machine, basically, to get in.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you mentioned this. The thing that actually was more scary to me than misconfigured molt bots, I don't like that name. They got to come up with a better name than molt bot. I don't get that. But anyways, the more scary thing was the supply chain exploit.
Yeah.
The one the guy did after the fact, where he essentially created a skill, put it in Claude Hub, and then found a vulnerability where he could essentially give it a whole bunch of downloads. So it was at the top of the list of downloads, and multiple people installed it. Luckily it didn't do anything. It was more of an experiment than anything. It just phoned home basically to show him that somebody had actually done it, and then it gave the user a warning message. But you know, the article as I was reading it kind of explains the idea of just the holy grail is kind of the supply chain. And if you can get in there, then inadvertently users will end up with this code, even if they've done everything they possibly could to set up these tools securely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a way bigger blast radius, right?
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking about with these is I wonder how many people have stood up a Claude bot in a work environment. Just because
that's a huge risk. Wow. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's funny, right? Like, Codex will warn you when you try to change the permissions on it. Like, you're at higher risk for exfiltration here. You could leak anything, right? And I think I saw a news item that had actually happened recently. Someone leaked. Yeah, I'll have to dig it up later. But yeah, it's a huge risk. Like, this is an autonomous system. It doesn't have your filter in front of it, right?
Yeah, yeah. You'd almost need some way to, like in a corporate environment. I don't know how you would do this. I'm just thinking out loud. Like, what's the, for lack of a better term, like, what's the signature of this thing if it's leaving your network trying to connect to somebody's other service, you know? Because I've set it up at work and I'm having it connect to some service outside, because you've got all these skills that are available to extend the functionality of it. Like, how would you see it leaving to try to identify sources of it in your own network. Like, these are the, to your point, like, are all the things that security is going to have to think about.
Yeah, you'll see, you'll have to have an egress only gateway essentially, and you'll have to have a firewall on that and monitor your traffic.
Crazy.
So what you do.
Yeah. It made me think of Jeff's CEO too. And I haven't used Jeff's CEO since I set it up, you know, just to see what it would do. And I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, you know, I set that up. I gave it access to my Gmail without really giving it a whole hell of a lot of thought. So I went back and I'm like, yep, we're no longer talking to Jeff. So I just disconnected it from the email. So it's easy to do this just because of the excitement of trying some of these tools, right? Like, it's fun.
Totally.
Yeah, it's totally fun. Yeah.
Very funny that Jeff is getting the golden parachute.
Yeah, Audi Jones.
But your Gmail is everything, right? That's all of your accounts, your recovery for every service, essentially.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah,
that's a big problem.
Yeah, you would if I lost that, I'd be in deep shit. Like, my whole life is in there, man. I wouldn't know where I was supposed to go tomorrow if suddenly my calendar wasn't there. I'd be lost. All right. So if you're using ClaudeBot or Moldbot, just be careful, I guess, is the moral of this story, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the other interesting little thing that went along with this is they kept talking about in the article how many people are buying Mac minis to run this thing.
Oh yeah.
So I was like, okay, really? Like, whatever. So I went to YouTube and I just typed ClaudeBot, and there were, like, in the first little chunk of results, you know, I had a lot of the typical YouTube thumbnails, right? Somebody looking frustrated, somebody looking, you know, like, this is the best thing they've ever seen, and you know, excitement and all this stuff. And there were multiple things, multiple videos about setting up your own Mac Mini or a Mac Mini just to run ClaudeBot. So it is actually a thing.
It's the best platform to run and host local models right now.
Yeah,
pretty much. Yeah.
Something
that you can buy in one little self-contained box.
Yeah. All right. What do I have next? In fairness, this article made my head hurt, but it was about, I actually found it on Ars Technica. And then I was reading the article, they give you a link to the source. So this is about basically somebody within OpenAI providing the technical details about how its codecs or coding agent works. And they explain, like, you know, everything that's kind of happening. And the way I wrote it down was, you know, it gives you an opportunity to peer behind the curtain. So in the show notes, I will actually share the real article from OpenAI. And it was more technical than I could actually get through. But it talks about what we've discussed before, and this idea of understanding, like, the agent loop, right? Sort of how
the
it's
loop
reasoning
is key.
And how it's working and stuff. And I'm pretty sure there was a piece in there where they were talking about, we've talked about the size of the context and stuff like that, and how it's essentially sending the entire conversation every single time.
Yes.
It's not just sending what's new, and it was a design decision that they made. And I can't remember from the article exactly the reasoning behind that, but every time you ask it a question, right, it's sending the entire context back using that and then responding with an updated response to you. So that's the one thing that grabbed me. I think I need to go back and read it again because there's good info in here, but my brain just wasn't able to store it all.
Well,
the context was already full.
Yeah, this was very cool. It was a very good read if you're looking into building some kind of agentic tool. And the part for me that was most useful was how they're caching tool calls. So anytime the model's making a specific tool call, they're caching it and providing it. So if it goes to make that call again, you're not burning any tokens on running it again in the history, right? That's probably why they're one of the reasons why they're caching the entire thing, but I've built that into, I've taken that idea for myself.
Yeah.
in the thing I'm building. But yeah, the loop is essentially input, build a prompt, do the inference, make tool calls, make observations, and then it repeats.
Yeah. Right?
So if you can cache the tool calls, which can get pretty expensive, especially if you're doing like web fetches or if you're doing reps through documents, that kind of thing, or you're just reading files raw, then yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It actually reminded me, just as you were saying caching, there was another new feature that Bedrock, and it might have been Bedrock Agent Core again, released, I think, this week. And I was going to put it in the list, and then I lost track of it somewhere in my feed. And it was about being able to cache as well in there. So you could, I guess, do sort of exactly what you said, is just reduce some of the throughput or the expense of, instead of having to go every time and re-invoke that tool, you've got the ability to cache it. I'll see if I can find it, and I'll put it in the notes, because now it has a little more relevance as we're talking about this.
Yeah, like the bottom line is the context is king for performance on these systems, and any little trick you can do to make the context better, more concise, higher quality overall for the task that you're doing will get you better performance.
Okay. Perfect. Yeah, I'm gonna have to go back and reread that one, because it just, this afternoon as I was reading it, just didn't stick in my brain.
It's dense.
Yeah. I got distracted with some other stuff, and I kept meaning to go back to it and never did. The next thing that we have is Kimi K2.5, visual agentic intelligence. Walk us through this one.
So this is another Kimi model. We talked about 2.1 recently, which was, you know, pretty good performance open weight model coming out of a Chinese lab. But this one kind of added what their models were missing, which was image processing and video processing, multimodal capability, right? So it turns out that what they've done is they've structured and trained this model with reinforcement learning such that it's purpose built for swarm architectures, which is spinning up a bunch of sub agents to do tasks in parallel. And it's kind of interesting because it's kind of the first open weight model to come out that is pretty much on par with the big three, which would be Google, Anthropic, and OpenAI, right?
Yeah.
So if you're looking for something that's like an order, like it's 60 cents per million input tokens, something like that.
Yeah, I looked at the pricing and yeah, I want to say that's what I read too. And then you've got a whole bunch of different options, right? You've got like a web interface, you've got API, and then do they have their own IDE as well that you could sign up for? I think there were options. Yeah.
Yeah. They released their own agentic coding tool that you can use.
Yeah.
But it's just really interesting, especially on the back of, the performance results are like just a hair under Opus 4.5, right? Like,
yeah, that's,
and on the back, on the back of Dario calling out for issues with calling the Chinese lab issue specifically, right? Like they're keeping pace.
Yeah, yeah. I wrote down like the agent swarm idea. So up to 100 agents, and it'll launch those agents on your behalf. So you don't have to tell it to do it. There's no configuration for you to do. It just decides that it needs it if it's working on something really complex. And then I also wrote down that it can execute up to 1,500 tool calls inside that little swarm, which I thought I wrote it down somewhere, but now I'm looking at my notes. I didn't. I just wrote greatly reduces the overall execution time for more complex tasks. So
yeah,
pretty interesting in the sense that you don't have to even think about it. It's just going to decide when it needs to do it, launch those sub agents to do the work, and then respond back with a response for you.
Yeah, really interesting, because a lot of tools are kind of trying to figure out how to do the sub agent calls and whether or not that's actually good for the task that you're doing, right? Like there's an open code extension called Oh My Open Code that I've been using recently that essentially does that. It'll spin up a ton of sub agents to go and explore and research the task, and then it'll actually execute, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, if you don't have to build that into the harness. It kind of does it better by itself. That's really interesting. So I'm going to try this one. I might use it as my default for a while.
Yep. Just to tell you.
Yeah. See how it goes. Yeah.
What, sorry, what did you say it was worth, or what, 60 cents for a million tokens?
Yeah. For input tokens.
Yeah. 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 It might be worth, I was going to do that. And then I was like, oh, I don't want to sign up right now. I was going to throw a couple things at it before the podcast. And then I was like, I'm not going to do the sign up process right now. Set it all up.
But it's so, it's so cheap. I'm just going to throw it or use it through OpenRouter once it's available on there and see what it can do.
Yeah. I was kind of hoping that, like, speaking of Olama, I was kind of hoping it would have like a local thing that I could install just to try it out. But, I guess I had a quick look. It's not there. I was just hoping I'd get lucky and I'd be like, I could run a couple things on it to see, but yeah, you'd have to, I guess, cause it's licensed. You're not going to get it through Olama.
Well, I wonder if it's on Hugging Face. I thought I saw something about that, but I'll have to check.
Yeah. I didn't even think of that one.
Oh yeah. No, I see it on Hugging Face. Looks like you can download it if you want. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I literally went into Olama and I was just like,
oh yeah.
I just was like, I just tried to do a search for it. Again, it was like after dinner and I'm like, oh, can I run a couple things on this? And nope. All right. What do we have next? I think this is actually a pretty decent segue from Kimmy is into agentic vision in Gemini 3 Flash. So the takeaway that I got from this article was that in the past, a lot of models would process an image in just a single pass, right? They would just look at that image and try to determine what's going on. And the examples they gave in the article were like, the problem with that is that what if they gave some examples, but maybe it can't exactly make out the street sign. It's a little blurry or something. It would just guess. And obviously, that's not great, right? So now what they're doing is they've built in the ability for the model to manipulate images, like crop them, rotate them, zoom in,
all
sorts of stuff. And the way that Google described it in the release notes was to gather visual evidence. So rather than guessing, it's now able to kind of re-examine that image to make a better sort of decision on what it's actually seeing. And they described, very similar to what you were talking about in the Codex, sort of peering behind the curtain there on OpenAI, they don't go into nearly as much detail as you get in that OpenAI article, but they describe sort of the loop that it's using, and they describe it as a think, act, and observe loop, in the sense that they'll analyze your prompt to try to understand what it is you're actually asking for and compare that prompt to the image and then decide on a plan. Like, how am I going to actually satisfy you're looking for the street name or whatever, right? And then from there, it generates a bunch of Python code to actually do the image manipulation. So whether it's cropping, zooming, rotating, whatever it might be. And then the observe sort of part of the loop is the actual model doing the work on the new data that's been crafted from the previous parts, or the action or the act where it's maybe manipulated that image to try to make the most informed decision before generating response back to you. So I thought it was pretty cool. And it was neat that they
really
get into the details a little bit on how it's actually doing it.
Yeah, this is super interesting. And I think it's really funny that the way that we're designing these systems now is kind of based off like thinking frameworks. Like, I don't know if you've ever heard of like an OODA loop before, but that's what this reminds me of. So it's like a military thing, but essentially it's a mental model originally for fighter pilots.
Mm-hmm.
So the acronym is observe, orient, decide, and act. So you're essentially, it's a step-by-step process for doing exactly this kind of thing, right? Like gathering evidence, orienting versus what you know already, making a choice and then doing the thing, right? So that's kind of interesting to me. And it's also interesting, this is probably a big part. I mean, if you're using this tool, you're sending data back to Google as well, right? So this probably plays into their whole world model thing. Like, how do we manipulate images and determine what's a thing, and how do we get better at boundary detection, all that kind of stuff. So I'm sure that plays a part in this too.
Yeah. I thought it was a pretty cool little article. They had a couple examples or demos on the website. I didn't have a time to go and kind of poke around at them a little bit, but just the idea of rather than just sort of making a guess, now giving the model the ability to basically manipulate that image to, well, make a better guess, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and also with reinforcement learning, if you can deterministically test something, you can train something on it, right? So yeah, that just gets it, that capability is probably going to get better just because of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was cool.
I'm stealing it.
The next thing that I put on my list was actually just something that I stumbled across, and it made me think of what you had mentioned at the end of the last episode. You talked about having a couple articles. I think you mentioned they were weather related and things like that. And it just happened that NVIDIA released something called Earth 2, which is a whole family of open models, open AI models that you can use in order to better predict weather. And I didn't go through the list. When they say family, like there's a whole suite of things that are available, and they're all sort of purpose built, right? Like I remember in one of them was, okay, like this is a model that is purpose built to help better predict 15-day or create 15-day weather, right? Weather models, I guess.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like forecasting predictions.
Thank you. Forecast. I could not. I'm like, what do they call that thing that shows up in my phone? My brain has stopped. And then there was another one that allowed you to do like a national forecast.
Okay.
But then also like scope it down into like small little like local area forecasts.
But have, like municipal
like a,
level?
Yeah. Like they gave like a range. In my head, it was like 1,000 kilometers. Where they could kind of scope those national forecasts down into these little chunks. So you get more kind of regional looks at it. But there was like a whole list of these different tools, different models. They have a series of libraries and frameworks that are all available. So it grabbed my attention because what we were talking about sort of at the end of the last episode where you'd mentioned some weather stuff that you'd stumbled across. So yeah, these are the types of things that I think, you know, really show the power of AI being able to help people get better forecasts.
Well, totally. This is like, I guess you would call it good old fashioned AI, right? Are they training? Did they use language models or did they use a specific domain specific tool?
Here, testing.
Test and releases. But regardless, like this is, I mean, weather, there's so much weather data that you can consume, and these models are so. The actual models to forecast weather consume so much data that if you can generalize patterns out of it and it's any kind of accurate, that's awesome.
Says here you can production ready weather AI, fully accessible for organizations, run, fine tune, and deploy on their own infrastructure. First open accelerated set of models and tools that enables developers to bring disparate weather and climate AI capabilities together.
Huh. Earth 2 models give us a 90% reduction in compute time at 2.5 kilometer resolution compared with running classic numerical weather prediction models without AI on a CPU cluster, said the director of the Israeli Meteorological Service.
Yeah, something else, right?
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you've talked about model stuff or weather-related stuff before, and it just was like, oh, this is neat, right? And how many,
this
how
is
many
fascinating.
Models are here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 if I'm counting it properly, unless there's something else.
Six models, looks like.
Six models? Yeah. So yeah, I think that you know, we talk about just, you know, we talk a lot about the technology and coding and all that kind of stuff, but I still think, in you know, in our previous iteration of this, we also talked a lot about the benefits of AI for like medical stuff and like, you know, using it to benefit humanity with these kinds of things, you know, better forecasts save lives. So to be able to get that information in a reliable way faster and to be important to the people that need it, I you know, I don't see how that could be bad.
No, this is awesome.
Yeah.
It seems like they are using Gen AI to downscale resolution. Okay. So they have like higher kind of like, I guess you would almost think of this like varying levels of resolution based on what you're looking at, right? So you have like an overarching model for a country, and then you can kind of zoom in and then kind of infer what's going on.
That's very really cool. Really cool. Now we've got two things left. Let's start with the auto code benchmark. I'm going to let you drive this one because I did not have a chance to read this one. Tell us what this is about.
So if you remember when we talked about this the first time, it's Tencent's benchmark for performance of models on automatic on various coding tasks, right? Well, version 2 just dropped, and to no one's surprise, Opus was the best that they measured in performance. They didn't measure Codex 5.2 or Gemini 3 Pro, right?
Yeah.
But
oh no, I see Gemini 3 Pro here.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I just clicked on the leaderboard. You've got Opus 4.5 Thinking is the top, followed by Gemini 3 Pro.
Cool. That just shows how much I'm not thinking about Gemini.
Yeah. It's so funny, right? How you just kind of, you start leaning on a tool or a set of tools, and they just become your go-to.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. I mean, I'm forcing myself to use Gemini a little more because I keep hearing good things about it. And I just, sometimes I forget about it. Right. And, because we were talking about Kimi K2 Thinking is mid pack. Let's see.
That would have been like
sixth position.
Yep.
Yeah. Which is not older than bad. The one we talked about though. Right. Cause it's 2.5.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the previous iteration, which is kind of interesting because that one is also really reasonable to use. Mm-hmm. So worth looking at. But the other thing that I wanted to come back to on this was, do you remember what the best programming language we saw in this was for LLM? It was Elixir. Yeah. So I think I kind of found, I saw some good content by a creator named Theo, and he had some good points about kind of why that might be.
Okay.
And it's also interesting that C sharp is the second best performing one, right? At 88%, which maybe you wouldn't expect. But like a common thing between those two languages is that the documentation is built into the code, basically.
Okay.
Like in C sharp, you can make triple slash comments and write XML in the document, and that code will self-document that way. And the nice thing about Elixir is that the way that the functions are defined, they're very, what's the word I'm looking for? Atomic. They have like, you can pattern match on what you're passing and what the function does in the function definition. So it kind of does what it says on the tin. Mm-hmm. And also the documentation generation is really good for Elixir, and the documentation quality is really good on the, on Hex, which is the, essentially the, library repository for the language.
Okay.
So it kind of looks like if you can co-locate your documentation with your code, it makes it a lot easier for these tools to understand what's going on. And if you have a really good set of documentation, then they obviously get much better at the language. So.
Yeah. So because it has the documentation, the models are able to basically be better with those languages because they're well documented.
Yeah. And like Elixir, how, how Elixir works is you have essentially syntax built in where it's self-documents. So you generate the documentation as you go.
Okay.
for the project. Like it actually builds it and creates the README for you.
Yeah, very good. Well, I'm going to have to, you keep throwing benchmarks at me. So I'm going to have to go and look at this and then maybe try a couple things just to see how they work.
And I've actually started a project in Elixir today.
Have you really?
And I know basically nothing about the language, but I'm diving in. So
there, yo, awesome. Yeah, that's really cool. And then the last thing, I'm also going to let you lead us on this one. I started reading this bad boy and I didn't have time to get through it. So this is the article, The Adolescence of Technology. Do you want to walk us through that? It's a big essay.
It's a doozy. And he's known for writing these extensive treaties almost on what his predictions for the industry, right? Mm-hmm. And obviously you have to take that with a huge grain of salt because he's the CEO of one of the major companies in the field. But essentially what he's saying, there's four things really. He's saying that tasks and job automation for software developers is like 1 to 2 years away, basically.
Yeah.
He's worried about a permanent underclass being formed when entry-level white-collar jobs get displaced. He has an extremely, probably the most couched statement I've ever seen, but it's like, we suggest that GDP growth could possibly reach 10 to 20% sustained.
Really?
About as couched as you could possibly get.
Yeah.
He's worried about AI enabling totalitarian nightmares, right? So like autonomous drone swarms, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of points regarding banning chip sales to China, which, you know, that's...
Yeah.
There are... It's kind of interesting, right? Because if you ban chip sales, then they just get better at making better chips, right? So...
Yeah.
But, and there's also AI models as collections of personas in this paper, which kind of the idea is that reasoning models, how they work. There's a paper by DeepMind called Reasoning Models Generate Societies of Thought. Mm-hmm. But kind of the underlying thing is that if you have a model that is just going linearly, task by task, and working on a problem, it basically says, I'm going to do this and this and this and bang, 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 and here's the thing. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. It'll just have the wrong answer, right? It'll hallucinate it. But if you have a reasoning model, you see a lot of self-questioning language in there, like actually, or oh, wait, I should check this, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that tends to generate better results. And actually, if you inhibit it, you get worse benchmark results.
What do you mean? What do you mean when you say inhibit it? Like,
so if you prevent it from using that kind of language in the reasoning step, when it's generating reasoning tokens, it tends to perform worse on tasks. So it's just kind of a really interesting thing to come out now. And it also caught my attention with all of their focus on the Claude ecosystem, like ClaudeBot, and the performance problems with Claude code they've been having, and the attacks on other programming agent tools like OpenCode, for example. So that just kind of struck me as an interesting, what's the word, contrast. And also Kimi K25 just came out, which is as good as Opus. So like, what would be the point of banning the chips at this point?
Yeah. My immediate reaction is I think that ship has sailed, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I don't really see at this point what the benefit of, I think it's done already.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting too, right? Like he's been predicting the end of software development for the past 4 years now within the next 6 months, right? So six months to a year, right?
Yeah.
Huge grain of salt required.
Yeah. I don't know. I see it in the stuff that I do, like in the, you know, sort of infrastructure as code and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's still... I think I'm still needed because I need to decide on the architecture. Like, okay, these are the requirements. Therefore, it's got to be multi-region, or therefore it's only a single region, but make sure it's in 3 AZs. Like, I still need to use the term reasoning. Like, I'm doing the reasoning still. Like, I'm saying, okay,
yes,
client requirements mean it has to look like this. Okay.
You're scoping
then,
still.
Yeah. But then I'm basically passing those requirements along with a very well-defined standards. Like, this is the way the CloudFormation has to be written to meet the customer's requirements. These are the way that we want all the pipelines to be deployed so that we can deploy this code. After I've kind of come up with the reasoning piece, like, how do I meet these requirements? Man, Kiro, like, it does a fantastic job at writing CloudFormation and CDK. Like, and I look at it and you know this, you and I have written a lot of more CloudFormation, at least when you and I are working together versus CDK. But like, I can look at that CloudFormation code that it writes and it's indistinguishable from what we used to write. And I think we were pretty good at those jobs, right? We had good, well-defined standards. We knew how to build these things. We knew how to tie them all together. And as long as you give it good direction and standards, it's done, right? I know that's not software development. There's a big difference between those two things. But like, I don't see how it's going to take very long to go from point A to point B.
I
don't know.
It's like, if you kind of think about it, the actual writing of those templates, right? You've already thought about and reasoned about what you want the architecture to be. You just need to stub out essentially the definition for that architecture, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same thing as like these tools are really good at doing easy code work, right? Like, if the task is simple and well-defined, they're great at that. But as soon as you get into something more complicated, you run into trouble. Or if you get into a situation where there's a huge context window, right? So it's kind of the perfect, like, CloudFormation is a great use case for this, because you have, it's kind of like an atomic little template. I mean, these templates can get pretty long, right? But the formatting is consistent and it'll either deploy or it won't, right? For the most part.
Yeah.